Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
You see, I told you we'd be right back with another episode. If you're listening to this and you're confused, that's because you haven't listened to the prequel episode to this one, so go back in your feed and do that right now. But for everyone who's caught up, welcome to the second half of the Paul Foot Award 2023 nominations shortlistees episode. We're about to hear from three brilliant teams of investigative journalists about the stories that got them nominated. And you're about to hear them introducing themselves right now.
I'm Harry York, and I work for the Sunday Times.
My name's Gabriel Pogrand. I work for the same paper, and our joint entry for the Paul Foot Award this year was our reporting on the BBC chairman, Richard Sharp.
I'm Jamie Tarsin, Vice World News, and our story for the Paul Foot Award this year was an investigation into the influencer Andrew Tate.
David Conn, investigations correspondent at The Guardian, and my story is about the PPE contracts awarded to a company linked to the Conservative Party peer, Baroness Michelle Mohn.
We kick off with Gabriel and Harry, who are going to tell us about a story that I think a lot of you will have heard of. It concerns the chairman of the BBC, Boris Johnson, and £800,000. Gabriel, tell us about this one.
So, our story focused on the undisclosed role that Richard Sharp played in the behind-the-scenes talks leading to a six-figure financial facility that was used to bankroll Boris Johnson during his time in Number 10. So one of the weird things about our political system is if you're a parliamentarian, you have to disclose anything exceeding, I think, 250 quid of hospitality or gifts. But if you're the Prime Minister, you can have a loan guaranteed by an individual, and the public has no right to know. And our story in a nutshell was revealing this loan, the distant cousin and foreign businessman who guaranteed it, and then the role of Richard Sharp in making it all happen.
There's one element of the story I don't really understand. The role that Richard Sharp played was, as far as I could tell, introducing Boris Johnson to his own cousin.
Yes.
To Boris's cousin.
That's correct. So that's certainly Richard Sharp's version of events. So effectively what happened was in September 2020, before Richard Sharp applies to become the BBC chairman, he has dinner with his long-term friend, Sam Blythe, who just so happens to also be the Prime Minister of the day's cousin. Sam Blythe is a wealthy Canadian businessman, but he has a house in London, and the pair go back decades. So they have a discussion over dinner, and Sam Blythe says to Richard Sharp, "Oh, I'm awfully concerned about Boris's finances. I think he's in a spot of bother." And then Richard Sharp's version of events is that he said, well, if you do want to provide financial assistance to the Prime Minister, you need to make sure that this is all done by the book. So what I'm going to do is try and make sure that's the case. But unfortunately, what then transpired was he effectively acted as an introduction agency to the government for Blythe, but he just so happened to be also applying at the same time for the job of chairman of the BBC. He then has a meeting with the cabinet secretary, as we detailed. None of these details were ever made public. He says that he discussed the potential conflict and that they both agreed, the cabinet secretary and Richard Sharp, that he'd have no further part in all of this. But what he failed to do was then notify either the appointment panel that was selecting who was appointable to that role. And then after he was chosen by Boris Johnson to become chairman of the BBC, he then failed to notify the select committee, which did the pre-scrutiny hearing. And that ultimately, when we unveiled all of this, is what led to several inquiries being carried out by the BBC itself into his current potential conflicts as chairman, the Commissioner for Public Appointments, and also the Select Committee also then called him before it to take evidence. And in pretty much every single case, they found that he should have declared it. It was a significant problem that he hadn't.
Right. And the reason Well, there are a number of reasons why this is such a problem, but one of the points to make is that Johnson's role in choosing Mr. Sharp as the chairman, he had the ability to put it forward as a preferred candidate, as it were.
Well, not just preferred, but effectively it's once the PM decides, unless there's some sort of huge glaring issue that emerges after the selection, then it's almost certain that that person then becomes chair.
It feels like the rules are pretty clear on what potential conflicts or actual conflicts you have to disclose when you're in the running for a job like this. It feels like that wasn't followed. Nonetheless, this feels like a very tricky story to report because of the very small number of meetings at which no notes were taken, which are the real heart of this story. Does that not present quite a lot of challenges in terms of the actual reporting?
Yeah, I think part of the beauty of working with my dear comrade Harry was that we kind of needed the other sources to get basically anything over the line, or certainly the full array of what we reported in the end. Couldn't have happened unless we were kind of simulating these conversations between different people who the sorts of sources you can't call upon very often. So much of this happens in the form of a dinner over chop suey at Chequers, you know, Notting Hill soiree, pastel coloured townhouse, having a drink and a tipple. This is sort of quite illustrative of how power operates much of the time at the apex of the establishment. I mean, these aren't minuted meetings with Sir Humphrey breathing down everybody's necks and ensuring that, you know, a nice Microsoft Word document is, diligently created to record everything that's happened. I mean, as you say, none of this at any point was made available to the public. And a lot of the time, even the civil service had no idea. Mm. And then there was the added issue. And this isn't a case of woe is me, because I mean it's become a sort of ongoing lesson for us. But that is dealing with Boris Johnson's team, and
okay.
Johnson's a great journalist, very 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 deft and cute when it comes to the use of language, and his team proved no different. And there were many days spent cogitating on the difference between a loan and a financial facility, and the fact that the loan in the end was up to £800,000 rather than that figure itself posed lots of problems and certainly delayed publication by quite a while.
I think Gabriel's being very polite in saying that they threw everything at us effectively to try and stop us from publishing the story, and it was a real tussle to get it across the line in the end.
Gabriel, last year you were shortlisted for the Pulford Award for your work on Prince Charles receiving, was it £1 million in cash from the family of Osama bin Laden?
It was actually three lots of €1 million handed in duffel bags and Fortnum & Mason's carrier bags, and then lastly a suitcase from a Qatari politician. But the other thing also happened.
Okay. I mean, I'm just sensing a slight theme emerging in your work with larger amounts of money being made available to pillars of the establishment. I'm just wondering if you can give us a clue about what might come next. You know, 2024 going to be the Archbishop of Canterbury receiving a brown envelope, or what next?
If there is a theme to draw, it is definitely large consignments of cash transmitted in irregular ways. But I guess, all these people, be it our sovereign, or the person our sovereign briefly put in charge of the government. There's a lot of people in positions of power who would much rather we didn't know anything about their personal financial situations.
Thanks so much, Gabriel and Harry. Now we turn to you, Jamie. You and your colleagues from Vice News have a story which brought you to the Pulford Awards. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, so we did an investigation into the British-American influencer Andrew Tate, who has now kind of gained notoriety around the world for his shocking content that many people allege is seriously misogynistic or violently misogynistic. And he gained sort of even greater fame when he, after a Twitter spat, a very famous Twitter spat with Greta Thunberg, he ended up being arrested under investigation, not formally arrested. He was held under investigation for allegations of human trafficking, rape, and forming an organized crime group in Romania. Our investigation focused on similar allegations that Andrew had faced that the public didn't know about in the UK. So we found three women who reported Andrew Tate to the police in 2015, alleging allegations of rape, physical assault, and sexual assault. One of those women was an ex-girlfriend of his, but the other two worked in his then Luton-based webcam business. So that's kind of where the parallels with the arrest in Romania arose in our investigation.
A lot of people only heard about Andrew Tate for the first time this year, I think it's fair to say. It sounds like you've been working on this story for quite a while. When did he first come to your attention?
So I had a bit of a unique perspective in... I basically came across Andrew Tate in 2019. A colleague of mine sent me a photo of her friend's younger brother sat across from his friend across a chessboard. And they put this quote that said, you know, the queen is the most powerful piece on the board. She can move in any direction, anywhere she wants, but a man can only move one square at a time. And that's the true value of a queen. And what was interesting is that Instagram caption was a direct quote from an Andrew Tate saying that had gone viral. And the image that him and his friend had recreated was the exact Instagram post that Andrew Tate had made. And she was like, there are these crazy brothers, they go everywhere, and they've got these kids who are so in love with them, they're imitating them to this extent online. I started looking at him. He at that point had like 40,000 Instagram followers. And I actually reached out to him at the end of 2019, and we started speaking to him about a documentary we were going to make alongside our investigation. And then over the next 2 years, he sort of bubbled along, becoming slightly more famous until 2022, when he went massively viral, primarily on TikTok. And it resulted in him becoming the most Googled person in the world in August of 2022. His videos had been viewed 12 billion times on TikTok. And he's kind of just continued to grow since then. I mean, even now, I think more kids, more people under the age of 18 in the UK know who Andrew Tate is than Rishi Sunak, which is pretty alarming. But it goes to show you like the scale of celebrity he achieved in a pretty short amount of time.
And so you had been working on this documentary. When did you start to hear a little more about these allegations against him?
So the allegations came later down the line, but the sort of red flags that there might be something further to look for came pretty quickly. And that's one of the things with Andrew. He's never really been like overly subtle with his opinions. He shares everything online in a very direct and serious way. And in 2018, so like long before he achieved any really real fame, he'd been on Big Brother previously, but had kind of a failed attempt at celebrity through that. But in 2018, he made a course called the Andrew Tate PhD, which stood for the Pimping Hoes Degree. And it was a course in which he would teach you how to make women fall in love with you. And then he sold a supplementary course called Webcam Dreams, which would teach you how to then get those women who are in love with you to work for you in the webcam business. So that was a pretty major red flag, because reading through it, it seemed at least unethical, but you know, it was just content. There was nothing serious there. In the course, he spoke quite a lot about how Instagram was a great tool for meeting women that you might want to get to work for you in the webcam business. So we did, at the time in early 2020, sort of a deep dive of everyone he was following on Instagram, and found a number of accounts belonging to women between the ages of 16 and 18 in the area in Romania, that around where he lived. So we thought, okay, but this is kind of a red flag again. And it wasn't until 2022 when he really sort of was catapulted into everyone's living rooms through their kids' phones that we started to hear direct testimony from women that had alleged that he had done these things to them back in 2015 in Luton.
And that's an interesting element of, I think a lot of journalists will be familiar with that kind of trajectory of a story, which is that you start looking into something, you keep an eye on it because you think it might be going somewhere, and then it's only, in this case, some years later that you find the biggest story of the lot. It does, you know, but it needs that preparatory work for you to be really familiar with it and to know what's going on.
Yeah, no, it was a really long process, and I think that was one of the great things that I'm really thankful to Vice for, is that they were really great at letting me just have this project bubble along in the background for 4 years while I did my other stories, and constantly touching base with exec producers and editors about that story. And there's not a lot of places that will let you do that, just sort of ripple along for 3.5 years without publishing anything. And, you know, the pressure to find a big story, especially as he became more famous, did grow. But, you know, the story was there.
And so one of the key elements of the story is about the police and the Crown Prosecution Service mishandling these allegations made against Tate. Can you tell us a little more about that as well?
So that's sort of the main allegation, aside from the direct allegations to date that the women were making to us. They felt that they had been let down by both Hertfordshire Police and the Crown Prosecution Service. In terms of the actual investigation, it took 4.5 years for Hertfordshire Police to hand over the case file to the Crown Prosecution Service. So that's like a particularly lengthy period of time. All three of the women alleged that they were pretty poorly treated by Hertfordshire Police in terms of how they were treated in the interviews. Some of them were believe it might have been because they were working for him in a webcam business. The other one, who was an ex-girlfriend, alleges that they just didn't take her seriously and implied that she was over-emotional. Sort of typical tropes that you often, unfortunately, hear in mishandling of sexual assault allegations. We approached Hertfordshire Police to ask them about why the investigation took 4.5 years and to respond to these allegations that the women made, and they essentially said that there was a number of factors, but that the decision lay with the Crown Prosecution Service. They handed it over to them and it was their decision not to charge. The Crown Prosecution Service, we asked them why they decided not to charge, and they just gave us a very blanket statement of it did not meet our evidential threshold to go to trial. But as some of you guys may know, like only roughly 1 in 100 rape allegations that are made to the police actually result in a charge and go to trial. So your chances of getting the Crown Prosecution Service to say, yes, this is going to go forward, are really, really low. And I think what was so unique about this situation is, I mean, first of all, he was first reported to Bedfordshire Police, by one woman in 2014. And then that was just logged. It wasn't taken through to a charge. And then a year later, he was reported by two further women to Hertfordshire Police, and that third woman joined. But while he was being investigated, still under investigation by the police, he went on Big Brother, arguably like one of the biggest reality TV shows. And Hertfordshire Police actually contacted Big Brother and said, we'd rather you remove this person because he's currently under investigation. And he was promptly removed from the show. But from the perspective of the alleged victims, they had this initial experience in 2016 of suddenly seeing this man they were accusing of these terrible things pop up on their TV screens in Big Brother. And then 4 years, 5 years later, it happens all over again with suddenly, you know, you can't walk down the street without hearing him playing on TikTok. You go into your office and someone's talking about this crazy guy, Andrew Tate, who's just done a podcast. And that's where this story really became so surreal, is while under investigation for serious crimes, Andrew Tate constantly does things that put you in the limelight. He goes on Big Brother, and even now, like, he's under investigation in Romania, but he's also one of the most active men on Twitter you can possibly find. And it's just an interesting dynamic, like this person who's so heavily thrust themselves into the limelight while having these allegations made against them. I mean, even to the extent that he invited journalists into his house 2 months after he'd been raided by the Romanian police on human trafficking was quite interesting.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Now we come to the final shortlistee, David Conn of The Guardian. David, your story is another one which involves large amounts of money. In fact, even larger than £800,000 sloshing around. It also tangentially involves Boris Johnson. Can you tell us about this story and how it came to your attention in the first place?
Yeah, well, it's very much larger than £800,000 because it's actually £203 million. And it's a story about the way that PPE was acquired by the government during the pandemic, when they were panicking and scrambling because we didn't have enough of a stockpile of PPE. And it was actually the Good Law Project, Jolyon Maugham, who got the first leak that there was this thing called the VIP lane. And also, he was making connections with these companies, which many of them were just newly formed companies, just newly registered companies with no capital and obviously no history. And this company is called PPE MedPro, and it was one of those. Like, it was formed in early May 2020, and it had multi-million pound contracts within weeks of being formed. I mean, we were told in the strongest terms by lawyers for Michelle Mohn and Douglas Barrowman, who most of the time had separate lawyers, that they were not involved with this company, that, you know, it was totally wrong to think that there was a link. And actually, this registered director and Barrowman's financial services firm in the Isle of Man, they do administration for hundreds of companies, and that the people behind this company were a group of very experienced business people, in medical supplies. In one statement, the director said, and it's a shame that the press hasn't asked us a bit more about these people, because we could have told them what experience they've got. So I went back and said, yeah, no, I really do want to know. Like, I have asked you who the people are. And then he said, we can't tell you because of commercial confidentiality or whatever it was. And the first story that I did was in late 2020. And the story was mystery investors. Company with mystery investors gets £200 million PPE contracts.
And again, is that another example of starting off with a story? You might have had an indication pretty early on that Baroness Mona and her husband were involved, but you had to start and then follow your nose for a while and keep digging away before you had the final confirmation. Because that wasn't when the link to Michelle Mohn came out,
no,
was it? It took a good little while after that.
It was a long time after that. This absolutely is one of those examples where, obviously, you can't do it all the time, but where sometimes there's something interesting and there's something that is in the public interest, which obviously £200 million PPE contracts in the COVID pandemic are in the public interest to report. And it is absolutely one of these examples. And we've talked about this many times, actually, at The Guardian, you know, with editors, of writing what you've got and essentially you're showing that you are interested in this and that, you know, you're reporting on it and then continuing to work on it, basically.
So we should, I felt like I should ask, with £200 million of public money being spent on it, at least the PPE was very high quality, right?
Well, in the same statement, the director said, we are proud that our PPE has undoubtedly kept NHS workers safe.
That's lovely to hear.
And it was quite a while later that we then discovered that one of the contracts, which was a bigger contract, which was for, you know, sterile surgical gowns, which are really important PPE. So we're not, the other contract was for face masks, that we're all familiar with face masks. But this is actually PPE that is worn in operating theatres. And the point of the sterility is not just to keep the doctor, the surgeon safe, but it's actually to keep the patient safe from any possible infection. And as it turned out, it had been rejected on inspection on arrival in the UK as not sterile and not safe to use. And I've been back to them many times saying, how could you make that statement when the gowns had been rejected?
What do they say?
They say things like, because now the government is suing over that contract for the full amount of the contract, $122 million, showing obviously that none of it was used, plus costs, plus storage costs, plus interest. I mean, obviously, we all can't say exactly what impact came from our reporting, but I can't help feeling that the government, in the end, suing them did come from my reporting, to be honest, because there was an urgent question asked in the House by Angela Rayner, and they were really pressing the government on what are you doing about this gowns contract. And within a very short space of time, they sued them. But PP MedPro, the same director, issued a really strong statement in reply saying, our gowns were all fit for purpose and it's all the government's fault and they just overordered and they're trying to blame it on us. So, but it still doesn't answer the question, but how could you say that it kept the NHS workers safe when it never, ever went to the NHS? And it definitely, the gowns definitely were not used to keep NHS workers safe, and they've been in some warehouse somewhere ever since. So after the reporting that found that, despite their denials, Michelle Mohn and her husband did appear to be involved in the company, that Michelle Mohn had first contacted Michael Gove offering to supply PPE, which she said could be through my team in Hong Kong. And then they were given the contracts, and then all the work on the gowns contract, which turned out to have been rejected. Late last year, we reported that leaked documents that we'd seen indicated that Douglas Barrowman had made £65 million in profits paid into the Isle of Man, which is obviously tax-free or tax haven, and that out of that he'd paid £29 million to an offshore trust that these documents indicated was for the benefit of Michelle Mohn and her three adult children. So she and her children, the trust, appear to have made £29 million from the profits of these PPE contracts to a company that she said she wasn't involved in.
This is something I think links your story, David, and Gabriel and Harry's story, which is how you respond and how you keep reporting when you get issued with incredibly firm and unequivocal denials. Does it not at any point shake your confidence and you think, oh, maybe we haven't got a story here at all?
Actually, no. In this case, it didn't. Like, I don't want to sort of be macho about it and make out that you're not bothered at all. Like, but, you know, like, to do your job, you have to consider really carefully what the responses are. And it's a really important part of the process, and to take them seriously and to read them carefully. But at the same time, what you're doing is weighing up the evidence that you've got and that you've found against or with the information that's come back. And I always feel that the process of going to people and saying, we've got this information, can you comment on it, is a genuine inquiry. Like, do tell us.
Gabriel and Harry, does that chime with your experience at all? Were there any jitters when Boris Johnson's team got back in touch and said, no, it's all a pyramid of piffle?
Well, I'm not sure how much we can say about the back and forth we had, but what I can say is having Gabriel and I have reported on Boris Johnson many times, obviously, as political journalists, and what I can say is it was the fiercest pushback I have had covering him as a journalist. So it was very clear to me that he really did not want that story to come out. So yeah, but we weren't fazed because we were confident, Gabriel and I, in our sourcing throughout. So it was more a case of just having to go through the detail, making sure we'd got everything spot on, and making sure it aligned exactly with what they were pushing back on. And eventually they did concede a lot of ground, so we got there in the end.
We should say as well, I mean, Harry and I were speaking from the Sunday Times, and we're about 5 meters away from the desk that we were kind of hovering over with our editor-in-chief. And I remember, I mean, I know the phrase hold the front pages is overused in cliche discussions about our noble profession, but I think we were actually holding the front page and thrashing out what they were saying and what we were saying, and they were irreconcilable. And our editor was saying, well, we're going to have to square the circle, or more accurately, decide if we're going with the square or the circle. And that involved telling him about our sources, and so it required the backing of our editor, Ben Taylor, as well as our own kind of conviction that our sources were reasonable and truthful human beings.
So that's something very interesting, and it brings on something I wanted to ask you, Jamie, about in particular. So, I mean, all stories have sources, and they need to be looked after to a greater or lesser extent. Some people are very happy to blow the whistle and for it to go public and to completely face the consequences. Jamie, particularly in your story, where you're dealing with someone mega famous, and when you're dealing with such sensitive subject matter, that must have been a big consideration of yours, how to protect and look after the sources for your story.
Yeah, it was a particularly tricky thing to go over, because obviously, like you said, the subject matter you're dealing with is extremely sensitive, and then simultaneously the man these women were accusing of these crimes is incredibly famous, and not only that, but famous for garnering a particular type of fan, shall we say, who might react in a particular way on the internet. And I mean, all of the women that we spoke to were very keen to have their faces, names, and revealing identity, like factors that would reveal their identity, concealed, but only because of fear of the fans. They were very aware that Andrew, of course, would know exactly who they are from them telling their story. Andrew Tate would know exactly who they are from them telling their story. But what they were more concerned about was Andrew Tate's fans knowing the faces and the identities of these women accusing their hero of these particular allegations. You know, we spoke with a long, long time with our sources before we decided to publish their story, and before we were ready to publish their story for a number of reasons. But we made sure that, you know, they had enough time to fully contemplate the action of what they're doing, essentially, because this is, like we said, an incredibly famous guy. But touch wood, all of the women post reporting have since all said that, you know, it's given them a sense of closure in a way that they didn't have, because many of them had never spoken about it before. And there is now also a civil case being launched against Andrew Tate in the UK off the back of our reporting on those allegations.
if I may, on David's story, which I have to say was particularly frustrating because I had been following the Michelle Moan story with a colleague, and I'd been doing this story, and it was very clear to me from a political angle, being in Westminster, that everybody who was involved from the politician's side was trying to run a mile from it. So Michael Gove, Lord Agnew, who was involved, and various other officials, in fact, Matt Hancock and Lord Bethell, all at various points had encountered Michelle Moan during the pandemic, and every single one of them ran a mile from the story. So, and also I published a story about the fact that she had been very kind of forceful in her kind of engagements with those ministers. So it was very clear to me that something had happened, that there was something not quite right with in terms of her involvement, but nobody else got to the actual nub of the issue, which David did. Just to say to you, David, it was a great hit, and it ruined my weekend.
And I am really sorry that it ruined your weekend, and it's now my responsibility to pay compliments back to you three. So obviously your story and that closeness and the closeness of the relationships in that story, and you know, so many times I just looked at that and thought, that is the actual chairman of the BBC. It told us so much about the culture of the country. And Jamie, your story, I think there is that generation gap where, you know, to people older than that, he might still seem like the first time we heard of him was the Greta Thunberg Twitter spat. And since then, to understand how huge he actually is as an influencer to young men, and what a huge concern that is. So recognizing the scale of that story that you've worked on and everything that you've had to do, as you've described, also, you know, that's great public interest journalism. So, you know, hats off to you.
Thank you so much.
If I could just say one more thing, I mean, I just feel like it is important not to allow this conversation to end without my calling out the way that David has just persistently been doing down a couple who have only ever been trying to help the NHS. Trying to put proper kit on the front line. I just think it's wrong what you've been doing. No, it's incredible. What a story.
What about you bringing down a good man?
the highest compliment we can ever pay is, as Harry said, that you've ruined our weekend. We don't even have proper weekends at a Sunday paper.
This is what I was hoping for, mutual recrimination. This is exactly what I was hoping that we'd descend into. Thank you very much to all four of you. Congratulations to all of you, and Jamie, to your colleagues as well, who are also on the list for the Vice shortlisting. And congratulations again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks a lot.
So, that's it for this time. You've now heard the entire shortlist, and if you'd like to hear live footage from the awards featuring a chat with Ian Hislop and with the Chair of Judges, Podrick Reedy, then there will be an almost immediate mini-episode dropping into the feed soon after these two, as soon as we've had the actual awards themselves. Check back in for that over the next couple of days, and we'll be back again next month with another of these episodes. This episode, as always, was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio and by Private Eye Magazine. That's it. See you next time. Bye for now.